Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Madeline Brand. Let's press play.
We met in a kitchen, of course.
In Chicago. We're both Midwest girls. So we met at Le Perroquet like 30 plus years ago.
And it was immediate bonding. You know, we were the only two women in the kitchen. We both loved cooking more than anything in the whole world.
And we rode along Lake Michigan. I was on the handlebars of Mary Sue's bike when we were going to work.
That was when
literally.
I was much stronger.
Yeah.
The storied beginning of two of the most celebrated chefs in Los Angeles, Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger's Mexican food empire, kicked off with the Border Grill in Santa Monica 26 years ago. That original location is closing. Coming up, a look at Milliken and Feniger and how they changed the Mexican food scene in Los Angeles. But first, it's not even September yet, but LA's 650,000 public school students have already been back at their desks for 2 weeks now. Statewide test results recently showed those students improving, but still below the state average. 39% meet English language standards, 29% meet math standards, and Black and Latino kids are doing even worse. Meanwhile, more students are enrolling in charter schools, which means less money for the LAUSD. Joining me now to discuss all of this and more is the superintendent of the LAUSD, Michelle King. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this is your first full school year running the school system, so you have a lot on your plate. First, let's talk about these test scores that came out last week and the achievement gap. Two-thirds of Asian kids met or exceeded the standards versus less than a quarter of Black and Latino kids. How come?
So I think what's important to note is the trajectory, and the trajectory is improvement, that in every subgroup, including African-American students and Latino students, we see growth and improvement. Do want to mention, however, that we were pleased to announce just yesterday our popular magnet schools and their growth, which we are extremely pleased by, as they did exceed the state in their posting of scores on English language arts and mathematics.
Okay, I want to get to magnet schools in a minute, but let me just highlight one score in math for Black students, going from 16% meeting the standards in 2015 to 18% in 2016. What do you think is the cause of this massive achievement gap? As I mentioned, Asian students, 67% achieving or exceeding standards in math versus 18% for Black students,
you know,
as one example.
The achievement gap is something that has, I think, plagued all of us across certainly our district, but across the state and the country, because this same trend exists across the state and the country, not only in LAUSD. So what we're doing is looking at opportunities to learn. And so as we look at our investments, we are basing them on a needs index and putting resources not on a one-size-fits-all, but aligned to where the greatest needs in to support those students that need the greatest support.
So when you say opportunities to learn, it's for you to learn. Where to put the resources?
Well, it's opportunities for students to learn. So what do they have in terms of their support systems in place at their schools versus possibly other schools? And where we see students needing greater supports, sometimes wraparound supports, psychiatric social worker counseling, pupil service and attendance counseling, counseling in general, then we want to put greater resources there than we might put at another location where the students are not necessarily struggling in a particular area.
Okay. Let's talk about charter schools. There are now more than 100,000 students in charter schools, which means the LAUSD does not get that per pupil funding. How much money are you losing every year? The teachers union says it's around $500 million.
I don't have an exact number at my fingertip, but we are right now in a charter schools. We have about 220 independent charter schools and roughly a little bit over 100,000 students that have made the choice to go to charter schools. But it's important for me to note all of the students in charter and in our regular schools are LA Unified School District students. And so for me, it's not about us and them or, you know, either or. It's just it's an and it's a additional model that, and it's a choice that parents have made. And I support parent choice.
But how are you going to make up that money? And what does that mean for the district schools when they have less funding?
I don't look at it as making up the money. You know, we receive money based on the number of students that we have. And it's important for us, and what we've been in the process of doing is prioritizing what we need to happen in the schools in which we receive the resources for, making a prioritization, and then, of course, a funding accordingly. Now, that being said, we have had an increased effort in terms of turning the tide of declining enrollment and really trying to promote the schools and provide opportunities and greater choice within traditional district schools so parents have those choices within the district as well.
So you don't see charters as a threat?
I don't see charters as a threat.
Okay, let's talk about the magnet system. This was supposed to be a way to voluntarily desegregate the schools, but it's really become a way for well-informed parents, many of whom, or at least some of whom, are white and upper middle class to get into the best schools. And basically, it's through this confusing and some would say convoluted point system. Is there a better way, do you think, to desegregate? Is there a way to revamp the magnet system so that it's fairer?
You know, the magnet system was designed as a result of integration, and that is the tenet on which the magnet schools were formed and developed. And yes, there is a point system that many are very well familiar with and have been in place for a long time. And our magnets are very popular, and it's a school of choice that parents have desired and they want. We have long waiting lists at many of the magnet schools. So what I'm looking at is expanding opportunities for more students to be able to access the magnet schools. We are looking at how can we, however, facilitate a better understanding for parents and more of a one-stop shopping in terms of applying for magnets and other choice programs through a possible unified enrollment. So parents can apply if I'm interested in a magnet or if I'm interested in a dual language program. They would have one place to go at one time in the year, let's say October, where they would have the ability to do that. So we are sensitive to the complication and more of the complication between the programs than just the magnet in and of itself, and looking at how we can streamline and facilitate that for our parents and community.
So would you revamp the point system? Because I know that that is confusing for parents who even have a lot of education and have gone to the meetings and have talked to other parents. It's a convoluted system, and it ends up being a way to game the system in certain cases.
You know, the point system, again, is tied to a court order. And so better education and helping parents understand, yes. And as I also indicated, looking at a unified enrollment process in which the magnet and all other choice programs would be housed in one system and would be at one time a year so that we could facilitate better understanding for our parents in terms of all choices.
The school year starts really early this year, August 16th, 2 weeks ago. We've heard from a lot of parents who say they don't like that at all. They're angry about it. Why not start later, like most other districts? I know it has something to do with testing, but other districts have to test as well.
You know, it's interesting. You know, most districts actually do start before Labor Day. And this actually came about several years ago when a subset of our schools, those actually in the Valley, decided that they wanted to have this alternate schedule, and they rallied and promoted the entire district going this way, and they were successful, and here we are right now. So when they talk about testing, they're looking at really the high schools, and we're looking at the advanced placement testing, which is given at one time in the year across the country. And students that started earlier, of course, had advantage because they had more days of instruction in that subject versus those that started later. But that was one consideration that was given. The other was to be able to conclude a semester of instruction and then have a break and then start the next semester of instruction following that break versus splitting off a semester with a holiday break in the middle. And with our push to ensure that we are able to get students to graduation and to meet the A to G requirements, this was looked at as a vehicle in which we would be able to do that. And as you know, and pleased to report that we are doing better and increasing our graduation rate, even with the more rigorous A to G requirements in place. And this is part of our strategy to be able to accomplish that. The board will take it up again. There's a resolution that will come to the board in September, and probably later this year we'll take up the final decision of how we will proceed for the upcoming school year.
And let's talk about starting the school day a little later. A lot of research has shown that it is beneficial, especially for high school students. They do better on tests, and there are fewer traffic accidents because they're not as drowsy, and fewer traffic deaths, actually. Have you considered delaying the school day start?
That's something that we are open to. It's being explored and looked at for all ages, as long as it would be something that all of our schools would be able to be accommodated, because that we have such extensive busing in the district. It's really about how we're able to align the bus routes. So in other words, I couldn't have a subset of schools starting later and others starting earlier. We would really need to coordinate that. But that's part of the conversation to see if that would be something that parents would be and students would be interested in. But it is something we're open to.
All right. Michelle King, superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And parents, we want to hear from you. Have magnet schools convinced you to keep your kids in the LAUSD? How is the process of applying that point system? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Joe Hicks, who died on Sunday, was an iconoclastic figure in Los Angeles politics and media. In the 1970s, he was a radical with the Black Power movement. 20 years later, he served as LA head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. That's the civil rights organization once led by Martin Luther King Jr. And 20 years after that, Hicks reinvented himself as a conservative pundit and activist. Here he is on this show in 2014 talking about the Black Lives Matter movement.
I do not think that this is beginning the new civil rights movement at all. I think it is young people huffing the fumes of a bygone era where you had Black folks and their allies in the streets around real, real issues that were affecting the daily lives of Black people.
Well, even at 75 years old, Joe Hicks continued to shift and change. Most recently, he left the Republican Party because of his objection to Donald Trump. David Lehrer joins us now. He was Joe Hicks's longtime business partner and friend. Together, they founded the LA think tank Community Advocates, which focuses on race relations. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, tell us about Joe's early life. He was from South LA, and I understand the Watts riots were a big turning point for him.
Yes, to talk about his background and the Watts riots and watching what went on and how he was treated by the National Guard really radicalized him, and he realized that things were not the way they should be. I think he went first into the Navy for a few years, then came back and really became a very, very militant Black activist. He even became a member of the Communist Party, oddly enough, and as late as the early 70s, when it certainly was not very chic to be a member of the Communist Party.
No, not at all. Interesting to see what has happened with his political philosophy, because he was a member of the Republican Party most recently.
Yes, well, I think on the one hand, it might bespeak a kind of going from pillar to post. On the other hand, he had a very firm moral compass. And he knew what he thought was right, and he didn't much care whether it was popular or how the political dogmas of one side or the other blew. So, you know, he was extremely active in the Republican Party the past few years, but the Donald Trump phenomenon just disgusted him. You know, I'm a Democrat, he's a Republican, I'm Jewish, he's African-American, so we were a kind of odd partnership, but we both converged and fought together on issues that we thought were important for society.
Well, he supported John McCain in 2008 over Obama.
Yes.
Why did he do that?
Because he was already a Republican. I mean, he was very excited about Obama's initial victory in 2008, just because the precedent set for an African-American to be elected president with over 50% of the vote was kind of mind-boggling. And then, but he had conservative political views and economic views, and they just didn't jibe with Obama, although he was very willing to listen to Obama on a whole lot of issues and certainly agreed on certain things. He was kind of marched to his own drummer and wasn't subject to the kind of blowing of political bloviators who might disparage him from the left or the right. He thought he did what he thought was right, and usually when it certainly came to social issues, he had his heart in the right place.
Well, it's interesting because there are not a lot of black conservatives.
No.
Many African Americans don't view conservatives or the Republican Party as sympathetic mm-hmm. to their issues, and if not, in the case of some, downright racist. How did he reconcile that?
Well, I think his epiphany in terms of moving from liberal to conservative was his involvement in the Prop 209 battle in 1996. Prop 209 was a constitutional amendment that was adopted in California. It was a very contentious battle, and it banned preferences based on race and ethnicity, essentially affirmative action, at the University of California, the Cal States, and community colleges and public institutions of higher learning in California. And he was active, debated all over the state against Prop 209 in favor of racial and ethnic preferences. And I think in the process of researching, in the process of engaging in these debates, he kind of came to a conclusion that he thought that these weren't good for the young blacks and young minority members, and it kind of caused him to question some of the principles that he had adhered to for decades. And as a result of that, he kind of moved more conservative gradually, until he became a kind of dyed-in-the-wool Republican until this year. It was out of still commitment to the same values, or just through a different prism. He had no patience for racism. He wouldn't tolerate, he wouldn't excuse, he wouldn't temporize with racist ideology or code words for racism or dog whistles. He had no patience. So that's one of the reasons he couldn't abide Trump and those who apologized for Trump. He just thought this is a bridge too far. He would acknowledge that you could have different views on issues like affirmative action without being a racist, but he had a pretty good sniffer for figuring out who was racist and what animated particular ideologies.
And what about police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement, as we heard
yes.
In the introduction? He was a critic of the Black Lives Matter movement.
He was. He thought that most police forces, at least, for example, in Los Angeles, he and I wrote an op-ed on the 20th anniversary of the riots here saying there'll be folks who say nothing has changed, but when you went from a predominantly white police force to a minority and a female police force, it's not the same police force, and that he didn't think cops woke up every morning figuring, how am I going to get, arrest some blacks or make life miserable for young black males. So he had a different view. He didn't deny for a moment that there were terrible incidents and injustices around the country, but he felt passionately that the greater concern was the crime that takes place in the black community in inner city, essentially black-on-black crime, which is just an epidemic and really needs a solution, and that was his passion.
And what was he like as a friend on a personal level?
Oh, he was just a warm, charming guy who was just smart and fun and thoughtful and considerate. He was just a lovely, lovely guy. And it's really a tragedy that a guy who was in good health goes in for a minor surgery and ends up dying. It's just awful. Complications from hernia surgery, of all things. Not a bypass, not a transplant, but hernia surgery. It's pretty awful. I mean, he suffered from high blood pressure, and I think that probably just worked on his system for so long that it was probably a difficult surgery, which shouldn't have been.
Mm. Well, my condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
And for L.A.'s loss.
Yes, I agree.
That's David Lehrer, co-founder of the LA think tank Community Advocates. We are remembering the life of Joe Hicks. He died on Sunday. He was 75 years old. Coming up, California is about to adopt the most ambitious climate change goals in the nation. But what if the state can't pull it off? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. July was the hottest month since scientists began keeping records. This year is on track to be the hottest year. And now NASA is saying that the planet is warming at a pace unprecedented in the last 1,000 years. Well, California is working to fight that, but it's going to take a lot more than just putting a few solar panels on roofs. A new law mandates an additional 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the state by the year 2030. How will that happen? Here to help us figure it out is Ann Carlson, environmental law professor at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you.
This new climate change law, SB 32, is quite ambitious. It did not come with a strict instruction manual. So what are people thinking? How is this going to be carried out?
Well, there are a lot of different choices California has to make about how to achieve what are really, as you said, very ambitious goals. We could, we're already doing some things that are going to get us on track. We have a mandate to get to 50% renewable energy by 2030, which is when the goals are supposed to be met. We already, along with the rest of the United States, have very ambitious goals to really make our automobile fleet much more efficient. But we're going to need to do a lot more than that. We're going to need to do things like transform our vehicle fleet so that perhaps a quarter of our cars are electric or some fuel that's not petroleum.
And we're at 1% today.
We're at 1% today, exactly. We're going to need to make our existing buildings much more energy efficient than they already are, even though we lead the nation in tough energy efficiency standards. Usually we impose that on new buildings, but we're going to really need to think about retrofitting existing buildings to use less energy in addition to cleaner energy. We can do things that, this may sound strange, but actually conserving water is one of the best strategies we can use to reduce energy usage because we use a lot of electricity in moving water around the state of California. Think about the Tehachapis between Los Angeles and the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. Getting water over the Tehachapis actually takes a lot of energy. So conserving water, maintaining that 20% water reduction goal that we achieved or got close to achieving last year and maybe even tightening that by 2030, potentially driving less, relying more on public transportation, building high-speed rail between Los Angeles and San Francisco, lowering the carbon content of our fuel. I mean, I think one thing to stress is that we need to do all of these things. No single measure is going to get us to those goals. Everything we do emits greenhouse gases, and trying to figure out exactly how to reduce them is going to be the real challenge.
Yeah, so this basically affects nearly every sector of California, what you're talking about.
That's exactly
and
right.
Radically rethinking how we operate.
Well, I don't know if I'd say it's radically rethinking because we already started thinking pretty radically when we adopted AB 32, which we did in 2007 to commit California to reducing its greenhouse gases to 1990 levels by 2020. Now, these are even more ambitious targets, and in some ways the first reductions are easier than the next set because we've done some of the low-hanging fruit. But we've been thinking for quite a while about how to reduce our emissions, and now what we're going to need to do is just kind of put the gas, going to press the gas pedal to really speed things up and make even deeper cuts.
The natural gas level. Well, let's talk about cap and trade because that is a big issue right now. The California Chamber of Commerce is suing in court to block it. The auction didn't go so well last time around. And this was a key strategy, a key point in, as you say, AB 32, the last climate change law. How does it figure in the current one, and what are its prospects?
Well, it's not completely clear what's going to happen post-2020. The California Chamber of Commerce is suing actually to invalidate one part of cap and trade, and that is the auctioning of allowances. And allowances are what allow emitters to essentially pollute. So for every allowance that you have, you can emit one ton of greenhouse gases. They say that's a tax under complicated California constitutional law, they're arguing that the legislature didn't pass the auction with the right number of votes, and therefore it should be invalid. But the state could still use cap and trade if it loses that case, potentially. It just couldn't auction the permits. Then there's a question about whether California can use cap and trade going forward post-2020. SB 32, which just passed along with another bill, AB 197, doesn't say whether the California Air Resources can use cap and trade. My own view is that it probably can, and I think it will be evaluating whether it will use cap and trade. One argument in favor of it is that it may produce emissions reductions that are cheaper than some of the ones that I just set forth for you.
Okay, what about nuclear power? That is a delicate issue. We are decommissioning plants, and how do we do this without nuclear power?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, one of the things about nuclear power is even though it has some environmental harms that really frighten people, it does not emit greenhouse gases. And the last operating plant in California, Diablo Canyon, is scheduled to be decommissioned in 2025 under an agreement that PG&E just reached with environmental groups. So it's not looking like California is going to rely on nuclear power, even if it decided it wanted to license a new facility. It's hard to imagine how it could do so and get it up and running by the time we need to really be working on our 2030 carbon goals. So it doesn't look like nuclear is going to be part of the California solution to cutting greenhouse gases. That means we're going to have to find other ways to do this. We're going to have to push much harder on renewable energy. Again, we're going to have to be thinking much more about energy efficiency so that buildings use less energy when we air condition them and when we light them and so forth. And we're going to have to push really hard on greening our transportation fleet, which is actually the biggest source of emissions in California anyway.
And you mentioned high-speed rail. That is in the very early stages. If it gets built at all, it'll be a minor miracle. How reliant is this plan on some form of high-speed rail?
So I don't think it's that reliant on high-speed rail, to be honest. I mean, there is a big problem with high-speed rail, and that is that the financing for it is supposed to come from the auction of cap-and-trade allowances. Right. Right now, as you already mentioned, the allowance market is down, and there's still legal uncertainty about whether the state can continue to auction allowances going forward. It's one piece. It's a relatively small piece in the puzzle. And again, like nuclear, if you don't have high-speed rail, then you have to find the emissions reduction somewhere else. So again, maybe a bigger percentage of an electrified transportation fleet, cleaner fuels, more production of biofuels, which have been really hard to do to try to replace some natural gas with renewable natural gas. What it does is it just mixes, it just rearranges and kind of makes us have to push harder in other areas if one area doesn't actually produce the emissions reductions we need.
Well, looking at all of that, how optimistic or not are you that this can get done by the year 2030?
I am very optimistic, and I think I'm optimistic for several reasons. One is, as I said, California's already gone a significant way down the path. I think that we've done so and shown that we can do so and continue to grow economically. And in fact, you know, we lead the country in having a green technology sector, and I think that will continue. And I think there's been political leadership that's been really important, and it's been sustained through both a couple Democratic governors and a Republican governor. The legislature is committed to it. It has some misgivings about exactly how we implement that policy. And I think we have absolutely terrific Air Resources Board, which is the agency that has to figure out how we're actually going to implement the SB 32 goals. I think they've done a pretty remarkable job with the AB 32 goals, and I suspect that that leadership will continue.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Ann Carlson. She's an environmental law professor at UCLA. And we'd like to hear from you. What are you willing to give up to help California meet its ambitious climate change goals? Let us know on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, based on a true story comedy about a young man going home to take care of his dying mother.
I just had never experienced death front and center before, and it's like such a weird, stupid point of view to be like, me? This could happen to me?
Other People was written and directed by the new co-head writer of Saturday Night Live. He's in the studio next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The new film, Other People, is a bittersweet story about a struggling comedy writer. He comes back home to Sacramento from New York to spend time with his dying mother.
How you doing, Sacramento? Woo! We got our New York City boy in the house. You're not too good for us now, are you?
I'm glad that you're moving home for a bit. Your mom's gonna need a lot of help.
Don't look at us. We're drug addicts.
I thought you didn't want to try medical marijuana.
Well, I tried it.
The film is partially autobiographical, though its writer and director Chris Kelly is anything but struggling these days. Earlier this month, he was named co-head writer of Saturday Night Live, and he's here now in the studio.
Hi.
Fresh from New York.
I have my suitcase. I just got off the plane.
Wow.
I raced right here.
So you're back and forth all the time?
Since the movie came out at Sundance in January, like, I've been sort of still at SNL, but then during off weeks going to film festivals and stuff. And I've been traveling a lot with the movie this summer. So, yeah, it's been fun.
Okay, so I said partially autobiographical.
Yes.
And, of course, most people ask, well, how much is it based on your true experience?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm wondering how much of it you changed.
I would say a decent amount. I would say the bones of the movie are true. You know, like the big picture stuff. You know, my mother passed away of cancer in 2009 when I was in my mid-late 20s, and I moved home to be with her. And, you know, I have two sisters and a dad. And I back then was kind of starting out in comedy. I was just sort of starting to get my first job or two here or there. And so a lot of the, like, big picture stuff is there and is true.
Just to flesh it out for listeners. So you are a struggling comedy writer and you give up everything to move back home to this sort of one horse town, Sacramento, I guess, a couple horses. But you feel you're basically a fish out of water because you're gay in a Christian community.
Yeah.
Your dad doesn't accept you and you have to give up everything to be there. And that's actually your life?
Again, like, yes and no. I mean, like, you can kind of, you know, I'd say like 50-50. You know what I mean? Like, I would fudge the timeline of my relationship back in New York. And
but the feeling
more or
of
less,
being a fish out
feeling,
of water.
The feeling of being a fish out of water and the feeling of, like, coming back to my hometown and being like, do I have a place here? And I haven't, like, really, really lived here in, like, a decade. And now I'm, like, back in this home. And I love my family. I love my mother. I love my dad. I love my sisters. But I can't help but feel awkward here, and I would think about this career that was, like, passing me by in New York, and then I would feel so shitty that I was thinking about my career, because I'm like, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be in the moment, and you should 100% of the time be focused on your family, because that's what a good person does. That stuff is true, and that, you know what I mean? So those feelings are true more than, like, every single thing that happens in the movie is true.
And your dad in the movie, he doesn't accept you.
Well,
he doesn't accept your sexuality.
Basically, you know, growing up, I grew up in a conservative Catholic family, and, you know, I was raised to think that homosexuality was a choice, and it was tricky, and it was, like, hard coming out, and it took me a while to feel confident in myself and confident in my own sexuality, and in the movie, I kind of wanted to show that, but I wanted to show that it wasn't, like, black and white, like the parents, because my mom was very conservative as well, too, and, like, you know, a lot of my family was, and, but they're not, like, horrible people, they're not, like, villains, they weren't, like, they were loving, and my dad was a great husband and a great father, but he just had, like, a completely different POV than I did on the subject, and it was tough. And so that's something I try to get across in the movie too. You know, one of the things I wanted to, like, write about was, I remember during that time being so focused on my own worries, you know, like, when will my mom die? How will she die? How will it affect me? Like, what will I be doing afterwards? Like, why me? What me? Like, and then it took me a while to be like, oh, like, it's not unimportant to think about yourself in that situation, but, like, there's other people going through the situation too. You know what I mean? There was my dad, who we had disagreements, but he's a full person going through this horrible thing in his own way. And, you know, my sisters were going through it as well, and my mom and my grandparents. And so,
but
it's also so weird because this is also a comedy.
Yeah.
Nothing that I've said sounds remotely funny, but it's like, yeah, yeah.
But there is a line that your character says that this only happens to other people.
Yeah.
So that's also where the title comes from.
True. Yeah, yeah. I think there's, I like the title for a lot of reasons, but yeah, I remember being back home with my mom and thinking like, God, this sort of feels like those cancer movies that I've seen before. Like, how weird to be like in a cancer movie now, or like, this is so strange. Like, you hear about a friend of a friend who's gone through it, or like an aunt's friend who's gone through, and I just had never experienced death front and center before. And it's like such a weird, stupid point of view to be like, me? This could happen to me? People around me could die? But I remember articulating that to a friend and him being like, yeah, yeah, it does.
Now you're,
it,
the,
now
other
you're the other people. Yeah.
How old were you?
I was 26. Yeah.
And how old are you now?
32.
So you're still young, and you were very young then. And
yeah.
So at that point in your life is all about you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, was it a way for you writing this movie, a way for you to rewrite the story in a way, and maybe think about it in a different way?
Yeah. You know, because I wrote the movie like a couple years after she passed away, and then it kind of sat around for a couple of years. And so then I directed it last year. And so, you know, I was one age when it happened. I was another age when I was writing on it. I was writing about it. And then I was another age and I was directing it. And now I'm another age, like promoting it. And I have like this remove from my younger self. And so I think the movie is sort of like a trip back in time to like what I was feeling when I was going through this in my mid-20s, when I felt a little more self-conscious about my sexuality, when I was a little less comfortable career-wise, when I didn't know like how I fit into my family, obviously when I was losing my mother. And so looking back, I don't feel like watching the movie now, I don't really relate to a lot of what this character is going through. I mean, obviously, I just feel like in a different place in my life, in a good way, where I'm like, oh, thank God, I'm like done with this a little bit. Not that I'm like this perfect man now, but like, I don't even know if I answered your question, but it was weird to like relive that experience, I guess.
Yeah, it seems so far removed.
But it was only good because people have asked me before, like, was it so depressing? Like, why would you want to like make a movie about like your mother passing away in that year, like that, to direct it every day and to like see those scenes recreated? That must have been so depressing. And like, there definitely were moments that were like super sad where I'd call cut and I'd be like, that was really good, you guys. And I'd be like crying. But it wasn't depressing because I mean, we've been doing a lot of very serious talk about this, but I don't look back at that time in my life as being like super sad and depressing constantly. Obviously, it was awful, but like my mother was so funny and so full of life. My dad was funny. My sisters, my extended family were like funny. And my memory of that time was that it was like weird and lighthearted a lot of the times. And I don't look back at that year as like this horrible, horrible pit of my life. It's awful that it happened, but there were so many great times, and it was sort of like lovely to kind of recreate versions of them, you know? Like, I had such a great cast and such a great crew, and like a lot of my mom's best friends were in the movie as like small parts here and there. And
oh, really?
Family, yeah. Like, there's a choir scene like at a church,
yeah.
And all the people in the choir are my mom's friends and teachers that she taught with.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah, and in the movie, my mom is a teacher, and in real life, she's a teacher. And some of her actual teachers that she taught with are in that scene as teachers. And so it was sort of like a nice way to like remember her. And it was like a lovely experience. I don't know.
The mom is played by Molly Shannon.
Yes.
Who's?
Oh my God, she's so good.
Great. Did you meet her on the set of Saturday Night Live?
No, I had never met her before. We didn't overlap at SNL, but last year was the 40th anniversary, or two seasons ago.
Uh-huh.
And so all of these people came back to do the show, like, you know, all of these like great stars that had been on the show since it began. And she was there, and she did Mary Catherine Gallagher. And so she was in her costume as Mary Catherine Gallagher. And I was standing next to her, and we were trying to put the movie together at that point, but we weren't quite ready. We weren't sure if the movie was even going to happen. So we couldn't really send the script out because it didn't seem 100% real. But in my mind, I'm like, oh God, what if you're in my movie one day? So I was going to introduce myself, but then I'm like, it'll just sound like an insane person. So it's better just to like wait and approach her if this movie is a real thing and not be like a psychopath. And so I didn't say hi to her.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Chris Kelly. He's the writer and director of the new film Other People, and he's just been named co-head writer of Saturday Night Live. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you're the first openly gay man to be co-head writer, head writer
oh
of Saturday Night Live, right? It's a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. I know. I didn't even like think about that or realize that until it was told to me. That's cool.
Really?
Yeah.
What does it mean for the comedy, if anything? Or how
completely
you write
changed.
Comedy.
Completely changed. No more straight people on the show. No more straight characters. No, I don't think you'll watch the show and be like, wow, this is different. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what is so good about SNL is that it's the reason that it succeeded, I think, for 41, now 42 years is because of its diversity of voices. You know what I mean? Like, we have, what was it, 15, 20 writers? I don't even know. And they're all hired because they have different point of views and mm-hmm. different voices. And, like, me being head writer isn't gonna change that. I'm not going to, like, clean house. And, like, not that I could anyways, but, like, yeah.
But I'm wondering if you have a character or a scene or something that you've always wanted to do, and now that you're head writer, you can do it.
I mean, it's still Lauren's show, you know what I mean? So I can't just... Yeah, it's still Lauren Michaels' show. So I don't just now, like, say, like, Lauren, move over, we're doing this sketch. You know, that's not quite how it works. But I... And also, like, it's weird because, you know, when I started, I thought, like, I would try sketches, and if they wouldn't go on, I'd be like, you know what, when I'm a little older at this show, I'm going to try this again, and then it's going to fly. And more often than not, it didn't work for a reason. You know what I mean? So oftentimes I've resubmitted a sketch and been like, here we go. I'm in my fourth season. This baby's going straight to air. And then it, like, eat shit because it was bad and it was bad the first time. And so, and that's not always the case. I mean, I'm sure there's gems that fall along the wayside unfairly, but it's a meritocracy. And I mean, like, what goes well at the table gets picked usually. I mean, you know, like, that's
right.
I don't know.
And so much of the stuff that's hitting right now is political in nature for the obvious reasons.
Yeah.
How do you capture Donald Trump when so much of what he says is so outrageous in the real world?
Yeah.
How do you make it outrageously funny?
I mean, how do you negotiate that? I actually weirdly have not written Donald Trump on the show. Really, I don't think so. Because it's weird. At SNL, it's weird. Like, whoever writes a character first or kind of first works on scripts for that character, they kind of... Then it becomes kind of their baby and they keep writing it. And so I haven't personally done a lot of the Trump stuff, but I'm sure that might change in the fall. I don't know.
Who came up with the idea of casting Larry David as Bernie Sanders?
My recollection of it was Sarah Schneider might have jokingly watched the debate and been like, this is Larry David. And then I think somebody had told Lorne, and I think he was like, I should call Larry or something like that. And we were in there while he had the phone call with Larry. And it took like a minute. And it was just decided. And he decided he was going to fly out and do it. And it happened so fast. And it was a good example of being like, holy shit, this place is crazy. That the power that you can just think it and dream it and then it happens right away. It was very cool. Yeah, and then he was there on Thursday or Friday to rehearse and then we did the show Saturday. It was very quick. I mean, I'm such a huge Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm fan that like I could not believe that I got to do that with him. It was truly very cool.
Was it intimidating?
It was intimidating because you're like, as a writer, I mean, he's a great performer, but he's also like such... an incredible comedy writer that anytime he would pitch a joke, I'd be like, obviously his jokes were funny, but I'd always be like, truly any joke must be great because it's you pitching it. And just pitch, like when we did the, Curb Your Enthusiasm parody, Burn Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah. Sadie, I can't believe many people are here.
It's a revolution, Jane. Millions of people. If we have a good turnout, we can win Iowa. Hello, thank you so much.
Oh my God, Mr. Bernie Sanders. Oh, I'm your biggest fan. And I'm telling you, I'm feeling the burn.
What do you mean?
You don't think so? Shake my hand.
You coughed into your hand.
He watched like the first edit of it, and he sat down with us, and I was just like, I had pit stains like down to my butt. I was like soaking wet. I was so stressed. I was like, oh my God, if he hates this. And then he watched it, and he was like, I love it. And he was like so excited about it, and it was... cool.
The fact that you had Susie in that sketch was brilliant.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, it was cool to watch all the different like SNL actors playing the different characters.
Right.
It was a cool week. That was maybe my favorite week that I've been at the show, for sure.
You have a great job.
It's a good job, yeah.
Chris, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Kelly is the new co-head writer of Saturday Night Live and the writer and director of the new movie Other People. It opens next weekend at the Sundance Sunset, and it'll also be available on iTunes. Coming up, rock star chefs Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger opened Border Grill in Santa Monica 26 years ago and took Mexican food to new heights. That restaurant is about to close. What's next for the Too Hot Tamales? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled.
This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Border Grill, Santa Monica's OG high-end Mexican spot, will close in October. Chefs Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger opened it 26 years ago. The food was revolutionary at the time. Gourmet Mexican was really not a thing at chef-driven restaurants then. Back in 1985, Milliken and Feniger took a road trip across the border where they learned cooking techniques from taco vendors and family barbecues, and they married those techniques with their French culinary training. Their restaurant set a standard for upscale Mexican food across Los Angeles. Leslie Barger-Suter is the food editor at Los Angeles Magazine, and she joins us now to talk about one of our favorite topics, tacos and margaritas. Hi, Leslie.
And quesadilla and tequila and sangria and all of the wonderful things that make our Mexican food scene so great.
Yeah, delicious. Well, tell us why Border Grill was so revolutionary and how it managed to hang on for a quarter of a century.
Yeah, you know, at the time, and it really feels like we've now had great tortillas that have been handmade, you know, for forever. But if you think about it, you know, in the mid-80s and early 90s, the idea of Mexican food being something that's sort of artisanal and gourmet and in any way was still pretty novel. A few people had done it here and there, but they did it with so much respect, and they did it as people that are just enamored with a cuisine, and they really introduced an entire population of Angelinos that hadn't experienced Mexican food outside of, you know, sort of El Coyote at that point to what Mexican food can be, and sort of its regional differences too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with flavors from the Yucatan and flavors from the north and the south, and what a real tamale was like. And it was revolutionary. And I think also delicious, which is why it managed to hang in there for 26 years.
Yeah. So what were their signature dishes?
Well, the green corn tamale is sort of one of the signatures. It's a recipe that's been reprinted a million times, and for good reason. It's just a delicious, sweet corn, fresh masa, and with green chili, and it's delicious. They do a slow roasted pork that's wrapped in banana leaves. They have their fresh guacamole. Even at the time, felt kind of revolutionary what they were able to do with just avocados and fresh lime juice. Their quesadillas, which, you know, bear no resemblance to like a flour tortilla pressed on a pan, which is what we all do at home. Mm-hmm. And it was just it was delicious, and they did keep, you know, reinventing the menu. They kept experimenting. They kept adding new dishes, and it kept it really lively.
Okay, we're talking about them in the past tense. They're not dead yet. Border Grill's not dead, because there'll still be one downtown, right? And there'll still be one at the airport.
At LAX, and there's food trucks, and yeah, I mean, it's still very much their sort of signature restaurant, I think, from Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger. It's sort of the brand they're most identified with, and I think it'd be silly for them to abandon it, and I think, truly, it's not, the system isn't broken. I think they're just seeing that they have a chance to kind of branch out, but I think the Border Grill and what it does, I actually went back not long ago where I hadn't been in a really long time, and I really, even with restaurants like, you know, we have Broken Spanish now from Ray Garcia, and we've gotten, our modern Mexican movement is really at a peak right now, but it still really resonates. I think the food there and the flavors are still really strong and feel really authentic and worth eating.
Did they ever get any flack for being two white women appropriating another culture?
Yes, of course. I think, you know, and that's something that is a challenge, I think, for any chef that's trying to dabble outside their, you know, born culture. I tend to take the perspective of, listen, you know, I think that they do it with respect. They don't claim to have invented it. And, you know, they had a unique avenue to hit a different population of Angelinos than I think would, are able to experience this cuisine outside of that kind of environment. So, but on the other hand, like, kudos for being two two white women who made a huge culinary empire for themselves in the 80s when, you know, aside from sort of bringing Mexican food to the forefront, as female chefs, they were really on the forefront of that movement as well and continue to be.
Yeah, and they also got into the food truck thing, too. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. It's you know, I think people for a while were trying to do anything but Mexican food from a food truck.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of, it seemed kind of novel. They brought that back, I think, is funny. But yeah, they still, and it's still one of the best bites at the airport.
Yeah, it's true. So what's next for them? What are they doing next? How are they branching out?
So, I mean, you have to remember that outside of being chefs, they're savvy businesswomen, first and foremost. You know, they had a TV show and a bunch of cookbooks and a bunch of restaurants. So I'm sure they will use this opportunity to open something that probably feels equally exciting in Santa Monica. You know, there's room for it in Santa Monica, I think, still. So no word exactly on what they're doing. They basically hinted in a letter that they are staying in Santa Monica and they are going to do something. And I assume it's probably still going to be in their sort of Latin wheelhouse. Susan Fenniger has Mud Hen Tavern still, I think she does, on Highland. And so
yeah.
There's still restaurants that they, and Blue Window is the little place that they have to. So they all still have restaurants that they experiment with that are sort of pan-ethnic. And so I think what they're going to do in Santa Monica will be equally exciting.
Well, thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
That's Leslie Barger-Suter. She's food editor at Los Angeles Magazine. That just made me really hungry, Julie Myers.
Why do we do that?
Well, let's hear what the listeners have said.
They are all too busy eating. No, I'm kidding. So we talked earlier on the show about climate change in California, how California is adopting radical new policies, radical when compared to the rest of the United States, to limit climate change and all that carbon that goes with it. And we asked our listeners, what are they personally doing to decrease the amount of carbon that they're putting out into the world? And Claudia Muhlenweg says that, hello, veganism. When we are growing animals, that's a lot of methane. It's really bad for the environment. So if we were all vegans, everything would be a lot better. All the electric cars in the world, she says, won't help if we don't address the cow in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good one.
That is a good one.
It is a good one.
Or the elephant, for that matter.
Or the carnitas, for that matter. Carol Springer says that she uses a broom to sweep outdoors and believes that we should ban and enforce a ban on leaf blowers. She says that she passes landscapers every day that are just chasing a few leaves around and just stirring up dust with leaf blowers. Down with leaf blowers. Nate Amick says that he sold his car and he commutes via bicycle and public transportation, and that his wife just bought a hybrid because the public transit system isn't as realistic for her. So we've also got a couple more vegans that weighed in, as they do,
uh-huh,
on the page,
right,
about climate change. But if you have any ideas and if you've done anything that you think is helping climate change or lessen the climate change factors, KCRW Press Play on Facebook, on the Twitters, everywhere you want to be.
And we don't really have a big carbon footprint. We have a small one. So there. Okay. Whatever that means. Julie Myers, thank you very much. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Bram. I'll see you tomorrow.